Blog Talk Radio.
United is on the air, Sunday night, got a great show tonight. We've been away 2 weeks, haven't we?
We've been away for a while. God, when did I open it? How long has it been since I ranted and railed against whatever we were talking about?
Planet of the Apes, I think, was the last big hoo-ha.
Nothing wrong with that, man.
It took two years,
but I finally came into my own, so I finally gained my consciousness, as they say.
So we're back, and we're back in a big way. Actually, we're back tonight, of course, with Joan Rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a show almost every night for the next 2 weeks. So let me explain for those out there that are not acclimated into the upcoming guests on the show. We're starting a series starting tomorrow night called Summer of 85 at the Movies, where we're celebrating the summer from 25 years ago, and we're bringing on a lot of special guests every night at 10 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Thursday this week. Here's what you got. You got Steve Guttenberg from Cocoon tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm.
You got Dana Wheeler Nicholson, the lead actress from the movie Fletch, on Tuesday night. You got Joel Schumacher, a great conversation that Jerry and I had with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was wonderful.
An hour long on Wednesday night. Of course, he directed St. Elmo's Fire that year and many, many other movies.
Mm-hmm.
of note. Name some, Jerry.
Well, you know, Flatliners, the Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, The Client, Time to Kill. Yeah.
Yeah.
How's that? The Lost Boys. That's good.
That's good.
That's
very good. Very quick.
Tigerland and Phone Booth.
Savage Steve Holland, who is the director of one of the great cult classics of that summer, Better Off Dead, he will be on Thursday night. And then the following Monday, Joe Dante, a great director who had Explorers that summer.
Mm-hmm.
Alexandra Paul, an actress from American Flyers, on Tuesday night. And for our finale, Leah Thompson from Back to the Future, and we're trying to finalize Bob Gale as well. Who wrote Back to the Future,
mm-hmm.
and then a critical roundtable discussion of the entire summer. So it is going to be great.
It is going to be awesome, and God knows what madness that will vomit from my mouth, that's for sure.
Oh, the madness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Before we get into Joan, because we're on a first-name basis with her now.
Yeah. That was an awesome interview, though, because
Before we get into J-Riv.
By the way, I just want to give a shout-out to one of our fans who called into the show a couple weeks ago, our friend from England, Godiva X.
Mm-hmm.
He's been promoting the show, all the shows, like crazy. So big thank you to her. Cause she's just
God bless her. And plus she lives
God bless anyone who would promote anything I'm on, so thank you.
And plus she lives overseas, so she's this is the middle of the night for her, listening in live. Yeah. Okay.
You know, it's great. But, yeah, this is going to be, this is a lot of crazy stuff going on the next couple of weeks.
You know, I said J-Riv. I read the funniest thing. You know how they have the abbreviations of names, especially when it comes to couples? It started with Affleck and J-Lo. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure
what
thing.
Was that? What was that?
Bennifer.
Bennifer, okay.
But now, is Jennifer with him and Jennifer Garner, the two, or is it a completely different thing?
I don't think they've attached anything to them. I read something for Roman Polanski yesterday. They're, as if it's too much trouble to type out Roman Polanski, they're now referring to him as Ropo. I like that.
Ropo, wow, okay.
Yeah, yeah, I thought that was neat. Anyway, so you've seen movies this weekend. I wanted to just touch upon these before we get started with the...
Well, the two movies, a couple of movies I'll talk about. I actually saw, it's really weird, in the last week I have seen a lot of movies. I'm going to actually start with the two that left a profound impression on me. One I watched on demand, which is The Father of My Children, which is a French film that just came out. And that's probably the scariest film I've seen in a long time. It's not a horror film, but it's just the circumstances of the movie about the main character, the father, if you will, a young French film studio executive. And he's saddled with a lot of debt. He's just in this almost like, you know, he's like the character, the main character in Woman of the Dunes. He can't get out. He's just buried with it. And it's just how it shows, the movie is about his, how he comes to terms with this and how he involves his family to get out of this. And it's a fantastic film. It's also the bleakest film I think I've seen since Requiem for a Dream. In that just, if you know who I am, if you know my story, if you know me, you know that this film really just rubbed me in ways that I couldn't sleep the next couple nights after watching it. But it's an extremely well-made film. The other film I saw that really moved me was I would guess it's the final Merchant Ivory film, The City of Your Final Destination.
Okay.
Perfect.
I still haven't watched that yet.
It's just really... I like it, I guess, the same reasons maybe you like Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Yeah.
And why I like the Whit Stillman's Barcelona or any of these travelogues. It takes place in South America. It's about a writer. It's about writers, the family histories of the family that the main character, Omar, goes. He wants to write a biography on this recently deceased writer, but his family members don't want a biography written, so he has to go down there, and he's trying to find a way to write this biography. He's a college professor. It's fascinating.
Well, I have it. I have it here in the house. I just haven't checked it out yet.
You have it in the house?
Yeah.
You know, I went to the theater to see this, and I could have seen... Oh, never mind. I'm joking. No, I'm
glad. You could have flown to Florida and saved so much money.
I know. It's a beautiful... If forget everything, it's just a beautifully shot film. Beautiful. Absolutely.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Oh, great cinematographer. But is this his first movie without Merchant? Ishmael Merchant?
It's his first movie without, but because Merchant had done so much work on the film, he felt that he had to put his name on it because there was so much work that was done that Merchant had involved himself so much in the film that he just felt this his name should be on the film, which is unheard of in this business. But
right,
it's a very fascinating film, and I've seen Splice.
Yes, a movie that didn't move you in the way that those other two.
No, it didn't move me, but it was it's an incredibly well-made film, but it was what I was telling you before we went on the air. It is a film that I think people who like horror and sci-fi films should go see, because if you don't go support this film, you are going to be stuck with a lot of bad remakes from the 80s.
That's what we've heard, you know, time and time again, because a decent horror film comes out, nobody goes out to support it, and yet they'll support the Friday the 13th remake and that kind of
And I understand that on a gut level, on name recognition, but it's like, I don't know, Chris said this all so well a couple months ago. You know, we like Greenberg, we like The Ghost Rider, they're great films, but the masses aren't going to go see those films.
Right.
They're just not. I understand Greenberg. I totally understand that. That no one expected that to make Night at the Museum numbers or even Zero Effect numbers for that matter. But I did expect the Ghost Rider to be given a chance, though, just given its cast and the subject matter and what it was based on. But
you're talking about you're talking about Ropo's Ghost Rider.
Yeah, Ropo. But Ropo, as we've seen, we're just going to call him Ropo.
Love that. Don't you love that?
I think it's incredible. See, we have a lot of people in the chat room. This is awesome. But Ropo, you know, what we've seen the reaction from, I guess, if you want to say the mainstream, It does now, in hindsight, that doesn't surprise me. But Splice, I thought, on the surface, here's something that's gotten these rave reviews, like Kick-Ass, you know, from the base beforehand, and it just doesn't translate well to when you get to that opening weekend.
Do you think that horror films are still predominantly seen as a teen genre?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Given the article I read yesterday, I think it was Nikki Fink, that the Cinema Score, and I've never, no one from Cinema Score has ever approached me in a movie theater for my whole life that I've been going. I go more than most people. Was a D, whereas Killers and Get 'Em to Go to the Greek were Bs.
Really?
Yes. That is at least of yesterday afternoon. I don't know if that's
wow.
Catherine Hagel was good in, I guess, Knocked Up, but that wasn't my favorite part of Knocked Up. My favorite part of Knocked Up was Paul Rudd and Leslie Wright, really, to be very honest with you.
Yeah.
Speaking of
Killers, we're going to premiere the score, the main theme to Killers,
I'm going to make sure I record that and listen to it for the rest of my life. But
it's a good score.
Yeah, no, forget that. But Ashton Kutcher, it's very interesting, that dynamic. You have Ashton Kutcher, who's really going to be famous for being Demi Moore's boy toy. That's really his sort of big thing. And I don't mean that, but that he's going to be famous for being famous more than anything else. James Gobel was a director, some director that was famous for just being, for the act of being famous, nothing else.
Well, I guess so. I don't know that that's his fault.
No, it's not his fault. It's just the situation he's in. Look, think how Bruce Willis feels. I mean, that's what I always say.
I actually think Ashton Kutcher's okay. Did you see the kind of the American Gigolo redo thing that he did with Anne Heche? Came out last year. Forgot what it's called.
What is it called? But now I'm very curious that you
I forgot what it's called. I did watch it, and I really enjoyed it. There was a lot of sex in it, but I can't remember what it was called. It was like one word, like spread or something.
Oh, spread. Yes, spread was supposed to be very good. I wanted to see that too, and it never really came around. But
it never spread. Never opened wide.
It never spread. My neck of the woods. No, and I don't hate Ashton Kutcher. I'm not crazy about Katherine Heigl, though. I think she's made one of those Megan Fox, Shia LaBeouf, you know, pissed off everyone, you know, rained on everyone who made her famous parade. And
right.
I'm not a big fan. I don't see what's so great about her, but that's just me. And I realize I'm in the minority in that one. But, I don't know. You either love Picasso or you don't. I don't know.
Yeah, and who's the Picasso here?
No
Catherine Heigl?
Here's the thing with Splice, though. I want to go back to Splice, though, because it's very important to bring up Splice. I actually think it's worthwhile seeing. There is stuff that goes on, especially in the second half of the film. There was no way this film was ever going to reach mainstream audiences. I'm sorry. There's no way. But it's the performances by the two leads, especially Sarah Pauly and I mean, I like her no matter what she does. She's a great director. She's a great actress. And Adrian Brody, I think when he takes these offbeat projects, he's really good for him.
Yeah.
I really do. But it's not a film. I don't know. It's like with Kick-Ass. You know, you're surprised, but you're not surprised. It doesn't catch on the way you think it will before it comes out. But I do think Splice is worthwhile watching.
Okay.
I really do. It's that second half is the whole movie is very controversial in a good way. My first reaction was disturbing, and I mean that in the best possible way because it made me, it made me uncomfortable. But in ways that the story progressed, I mean, that's good. I'm glad it touched buttons like that.
Very few
really
movies do
deserve to be seen. It's by a director who made a fascinating movie called Cube that if you haven't seen, I would strongly suggest you watch. Just to really talk about a mind fuck. Both films are mind fucks, but that one especially. But it's good. I do recommend it. I really do.
Okay. So go see Splice. That's the theme of this first 15 minutes.
I've talked about. Go see all of them. They're all good.
Another great movie that opens up Friday is a documentary. Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, is the title of the documentary, and obviously it's about Joan Rivers, but it follows her for kind of a year in her life, which was last year, which actually turned out to be one of the best years of her career as of late. So it was a really great time that the documentarians chose to follow her. And it's really a fascinating portrait of, first of all, you know, who she is, her day-to-day, what it took her to get to where she is, what it takes her to stay in the game and on top, the fight of getting older in this business, and an insider's take, too, into the comedy world, how challenging it can be and exhausting, and how much work actually goes into telling jokes. I mean, it's a very fascinating movie. And I recommend it highly to everyone out there. If you live in the New York area, it opens up this Friday, June 11th, and it'll be available on demand as well, we've been told. And it'll, you know, spread throughout the country in different cities as the weeks go by. But Jerry and I had a chance to speak to Joan Rivers, and this was, I think it was two weeks ago, and it was the day before the Celebrity Apprentice finale.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Of which she was going to take part. So that explains one of the last questions we ask. But here is Joan.
I mean, how depressing is this? 40 years in the business, and this is where you end up. No Vegas, no giant club date. Kathy Griffin's taking all those.
What can you get me another commercial?
I'll show you fear. That's fear. Last year was a very difficult year.
Joan will turn nothing down.
I will do anything. I will wear a diaper. I love Texas to do other things. You can iron, you can read a book, get your emails on your BlackBerry. These are all my jokes over the last 30 years. Why should a woman cook? So her husband can say, my wife makes a delicious cake to some hooker? And you wonder why I'm still working.
All stand-ups are innately insecure.
Age, it's the one mountain that you can't overcome. I have no one to say, you remember, and that is very difficult.
I think they need that reassurance. It's all a cover.
I started with the plastic surgery, then I became the poster girl for it, then I became the Joker.
It's bacon, you idiot.
Nobody looks like her. Maybe the Queen of England.
This is how Maria Antoinette would have lived if she had had money.
I'm getting ready to go to Wisconsin. When I say, where are the gays? They're going to tell us dead. We killed them.
There's always an adjective before my name, and it's never a nice adjective.
Oh, short turn against the queen.
She is a snake.
Watching the way that Phyllis Diller paved the way for her, I wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for John.
How can you not find Osama? He's on dialysis. There is one outlet in all of Afghanistan. Find a plug. Like torture's band. Get a Brazilian wax. You'll give up secrets like you never knew you had.
I loved your movie.
That, and make sure you say that.
I will fill the hour saying and I'm wondering, it wasn't, when I watched it, it was surprising in that there's some biographical stuff in there, of course, but it mostly follows you. It's kind of a year in the professional life of Joan Rivers for the most part. Is that how they pitched it to you?
Well, they just said, let's go follow you around and see what happens. And I thought these are two terrific girls that did it, because they had done a thing on Darfur and they had done a thing on someone that was electrocuted unjustly. So I knew it wasn't going to be a puff piece, which is exactly what I did not want.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it was terrific what they did and what they chose.
Yeah.
And
you had,
and it should have surprises. If someone's paying money, God damn it, they better walk out of the theater and say, that was worth it.
Yes. And it so is. And it, but you had no trepidation about cameras. I mean, you've been in the public eye forever, but this is particularly invasive, I would think, because cameras are following you everywhere.
Yeah, but you forget. Remember, it was almost 16 months. So after 2 days, they become part of the family,
mm-hmm.
and they become your entourage.
Right, okay.
And it's great. I mean, when we stopped filming, there was a big void left in my life. These are guys that are with me for Thanksgiving and Christmas and Passover. And these went with me with Cooper on trips. And so you don't even notice the cameras running anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a quick question. When you are doing this, is there any point while this is going on, do you ever get a point like subconsciously or consciously where you want to keep something secret, or do you just let it all out? Do you just let it
as
naturally as possible?
You forget it's 16 months.
Okay.
And you truly forget. And they become family friends.
Okay.
What opportunities did you see with it? What did you want it to do, this project?
I wanted it to show really what the life is in a performer that's aging and the barriers that you have because of that. Mm. And I think they, because that's what I'm fascinated by age, because everybody has to go through this. This is the final mountain, and I don't care who you are. You can be Meryl Streep. It's still going to hit you like a brick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I wanted that very much to be part of it. And I think they covered that a little. I don't know. I'm so close to it, but I think that was covered. And I love the whole thing about comedy and how difficult comedy is or not difficult. And also, I love the idea of survival. I think people should see. Stop whining and get on with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that comes through loud and clear in the movie. What's part of what surprised me about you in the film is you've been in the business for a long time. There's been ups and downs, but the negative reviews still hit you pretty close to the bone, don't they?
Oh, of course, and also because when the review that they read, which now makes me laugh. In the film,
mm-hmm.
This man's just so self-serving and whiny and emotional. Well, you asshole, it ends with a joke. It was the biggest laugh in the play.
Mm-hmm.
And so reviews get you very upset when they miss the whole point.
Right.
You know, and don't you wish you could call back and say, listen, moron, you missed the point.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But
have you ever lashed back at a critic? Have you ever
returned? No.
No.
Why bother? Why bother? You know, what you do is you pretend you didn't see it.
Yeah. At the same time, the audience, because the scenes that we're talking about involve a show that you did, that you took to England.
England. We got raves in San Francisco, raves in California, raves in Edinburgh. Then we took it to England, and we got three bad reviews. And in the documentary, they show the three bad reviews. They don't show where they were carrying you through the streets in San Francisco. You know, but it makes for a better movie. And it was true. I didn't bring it into New York. Three bad reviews. I said, I'm not going into New York to have those sons of bitches decide.
Yeah. At the same time, the audience loved it.
The audiences loved it.
Yeah. And I'm sure the audiences are loving this film. And this film actually might, ironically, give you some of the best reviews of your career, I would think.
I don't want to jinx it, but so far we haven't had one bad, we've had great reviews. We've had like 500 reviews, you know what I mean, everywhere you look.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all amazing, and that is, I'm so happy, I'm not being corny. It's great for me, because I didn't expect it. And the filmmakers are just tap dancing around now. I mean,
right.
Put them on the map, and that's so good for them.
Are you as invested in the reaction to this film as you would be your own show or your own comedy act?
Well, great question. The nice thing is if people don't like it, you say, not my fault. Speak to documentarians. But the minute people love it, I'm totally invested in it.
One other thing that came up, you always, first and foremost, you say that you considered yourself an actress. That's
yeah.
the one thing you prize most.
And that's
about
the
your
one
career.
Thing. Don't touch me with. Yeah, that's the one. That's my Achilles heel. Yes.
Yeah. Was a movie career a big part of that for you? And is that a regret that you haven't had more?
A regret? I want to commit suicide every time I see Meryl Streep, that bitch, doing something I could do better.
That's a great, I love the honesty. I love that. That's wonderful.
You should have seen what I would have done to Precious. I would have made you sob.
I love it already. I wish I had seen that version instead.
Joan Rivers is Precious. Would have been the end.
But I have a question for you. I was curious. Because of your stand-up comedy roots and your stand-up comedy, you are an icon in that.
Yeah, right.
No, you are. We grew up with you. So I'm curious, what do you think, has it changed a lot, the newer generation of comedians that have come
up? Oh, yes.
Up?
Yeah, I think comedy is great because it's so rough now.
Mm-hmm.
And you can deal with subjects. I couldn't go. I mean, if you look in the documentary, I'm on Ed Sullivan, and they think I'm being very wild, and the jokes are so sweet, you know.
Right,
and
right.
Now I'm working constantly. I do concerts all the time, and I talk about subjects you wouldn't dare go near,
mm-hmm.
and talk about them roughly. And it's very funny. People over 50 say to me, "You're filthy. You're talking about," and everyone under 50 goes, "Boy, that's hilarious."
Is it harder to, I don't know that shocking, that being shocking is the main motive here, but is it harder to be shocking in today's comedy climate?
No, I think it's just as hard as it always was to make them look at the truth. And I think that's the comedian's job, is to say, you idiots, the emperor has no clothes. And that's where Can We Talk came from, which was
right.
really say, can we talk? I mean, you want to tell the truth or not? And now what I say to them, I get so mad at them sometimes. When I'll do a joke about, you know, the widows of 9/11, not all of them so unhappy because they got rid of a guy and they got insurance. I just get to the audience, I say, would you rather I did stewardess jokes? And they, is that what you want? I could give you a stewardess joke. Well, you want to really talk here.
Yeah. But they picked a great year to follow you.
Luckily.
Yeah.
When we started...
Did you feel that this was a particularly special year for you?
Are you out of your mind? I thought I was dying on the vine. I thought it was going to be like a pity year. And you see, when I said the Bronx at 4 o'clock, I wasn't kidding. No, it turned out to be an amazing... Which is why the business is so great. Because you don't know what's coming, and conversely, why the business is so terrible, because you don't know what's coming.
Right.
But you keep at it. I mean, that's
I love
really
it.
Key. Yeah, yeah. What has your reaction been, your personal reaction seeing the movie? Do you feel oddly about it?
I cry every time. First of all, I'm very proud of Melissa's insights, because she's never that deep with me.
Mm-hmm.
We never get past how much Gucci costs. You know, so here's my daughter really saying very smart things. You go, who is that? So that's what I'm very proud of. Melissa. I love that. It makes me cry when we talk about that wonderful girl, Flo Fox, and then I go to bring her food.
Mm-hmm.
Because people end up in such weird places.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of parts that I literally cry at. You know, I get so upset with the heckler. Because it does kill know what he's going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is one of the most memorable parts of the movie.
Yeah.
Does that happen very often?
Never. It was probably, of course, and weren't they lucky to get it on film? Probably once in 7 years. If
Ooh.
That, you'll have someone stand up and be that way.
Yeah. Mm.
I literally cannot remember anyone ever being that upset and angry and standing up in an audience. And as I said, and that they were there, the documentarians. How lucky for them. Again, it's the old story, how lucky for them.
Lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
moment. So this film, which is great, everyone needs to go out and see it. It opens June 11th.
Yes.
Limited,
and then really spills out, I think, the end of June.
Okay, good.
Is it going to be one of those on-demand, because it's IFC, you know, if it's going to be on-demand?
It'll probably be on-demand, too. I'm so not in that part of the business.
Okay.
Well, I just love it when we're
I'll
in theaters. You know how great it is to walk down the street and the theater in my little town in Connecticut is going to play it?
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful.
That's great. That's
well, no one goes to that theater, but the point is, if they did go in the barn, in the Bantam barn, it's there.
Well, tell me, you've got a few other projects going on. Could you tell me about those real quick?
Oh, yeah. How'd You Get So Rich, which I adore, which is the second year on TV Land every Wednesday night, 10 o'clock. That's doing very well. We're very happy. And then Melissa and I start our own reality show to tape it in July, and it goes on the air, they think, in December.
Oh,
what,
cool.
What network will that be?
That's We, and that's December 2nd on We.
Okay.
How'd You Get So Rich is TV Land.
TV Land, okay.
And then I'm back on E, so I'm just all letters.
You're all those, yeah, that's right. And are you back on, are you doing Celebrity Apprentice tomorrow, the live
I'm doing
show?
Celebrity Apprentice tomorrow, and it's going to be something, because how can you say to Bret Michaels, you're fired if the poor guy's back in the hospital.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Had a stroke.
Wake him out of the coma to tell him.
Yeah.
The country's rooting for him, so I that would be
not.
A big shock.
Yeah, I mean, he's been through so much, yeah.
Absolutely. Joan, thank you. We love you.
A pleasure. Thank you so much. Lovely talking to both of you.
So thank you.
thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
These are all my jokes. These are jokes over the last 30 years. These are just... Every time I write a joke, I try to remember to get it on a card. Why should a woman cook? So her husband can say, my wife makes a delicious cake to some hooker? And you wonder why I'm still working at this age. People think it comes so easily. They have no idea that what you're doing is a tremendously difficult thing to do. And I prepare like a crazy lady. And here I am. I mean, everything is just, everywhere you look, there are jokes. Everywhere there are jokes to be filed, jokes to be written, jokes that I thought of something. I mean, my life is just jokes.
All right, that's Joan Rivers. The movie is Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, that opens in limited release on Friday the 11th and then expands wider as the weeks go on. And look for it on IFC On Demand as well. I'm sure it'll be on there.
Yeah, it should be, yeah. By the end of the
Joan Rivers is precious.
That would definitely make me want to revisit the movie if she was.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, what's going on?
What's up?
Yeah, what's up, man?
What's up? Just listening to the Joan Rivers interview here.
I'm sorry, we went a little bit over with it. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I mean,
no need to apologize. I was enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. I wish we had more time with her.
Yeah. Before everyone logs off in our chat room, I just wanted to remind everyone that we have a 2-week series starting tomorrow night, in case you guys weren't here at the beginning, where we celebrate the summer of 1985 at the movies, because 80s nostalgia is all the rave, and we've done this for the past 3 years now. So we'll have guests like Joel Schumacher, Steve Guttenberg, Leah Thompson, Joe Dante. Go to our website, moviegeeksunited.net, or check this homepage here for our listing of shows starting tomorrow night, every night for the next 2 weeks, minus the weekends. All right. Chris, have you seen anything of note? That's what I always like to ask when we bring you on first thing.
I don't think there is anything of note to be seen.
Anything of sour note?
No, I don't. I have not gone to see any of the turds that are out in the theater right now. I don't have any interest in, Shrek or Prince of Persia or Sex and the City, although my wife goes and sees every single one of these.
Oh, really?
I have not seen any of them, no.
She'll be first in line for the Twilight movie, right?
She will indeed. She's a big fan of
I have a question about that one.
I can excuse the Twilight movies more than I can the Prince of Persia, you know.
Oh, yeah, of course. I have a question, though, because we have David Slade, who did 30 Days a Night, and Hard Candy has directed this one. And some of the early buzz has been it's good. Regardless of that, though, do you think it's a good move on his – I mean, if you're a director, you're a young and oncoming director, I mean, you see an opportunity like this, you take it. I don't care who you are. I mean, do you think it will give him – because this film will do well regardless. I mean, it will make money. Do you think it will give him, like, some leverage maybe in wanting to go back to do something like Hard Candy or even 30 Days
yeah.
a Night?
It has to, doesn't it? I mean,
isn't that why you would want to do this?
I would think so. It's got to be a win-win. Because I think that this series, like, obviously the studio is going to have kind of somewhat tight control over who does it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it doesn't matter who directs it. They're going to have an idea of what it needs to be, and if it's not that when it's turned in, they're going to take it out of your hands and make it that.
Right.
And that's why, I mean, you wouldn't get any director who has, you know, final cut isn't going to be making one of these movies. The studio
true,
has final
true.
Cut. So it's got to work out in his favor, and, you know, good for him.
Yeah,
I don't
know.
Hang on real quick. I just gotta say sentence because I'm testing the audio on my phone line. Okay, that's all I have to do. Go ahead, continue.
Okay.
Well, yeah. Anyway, like I was saying, yeah, I think it's got to be a win-win situation for him.
Okay. No, that's what I thought. I mean, I just think it's something you do. You do this big tentpole movie. The biggest, right, one of the biggest right now. And you hopefully will, you know, have, you know, when you say, hey, I've written this or I want to do this, I would, you know, and they'll say, yeah, sure, you can do it.
Yeah. I mean, worst case scenario, you direct a movie that makes $300 million. Best case scenario, you direct, you know, what could be, you know, the Empire Strikes Back of this series, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
there
that's
has to be one
possible.
Eventually, like.
Possible.
Yeah.
Not certain, but it's, from what I hear from, that this series gets better, supposedly, whether that translates cinematically, I have no idea. But isn't
The Empire Strikes Back of the Twilight series the same thing as the Beverly Hills Cop 3 of that series?
There's a lot of truth in that.
No, that's probably true, like, but you got to remember, like, it's not adults that, this is the Star Wars for a whole new generation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't give a shit about it, and neither do you, but there's a huge generation of girls, mostly girls,
yeah.
but some guys, too, that are totally into this shit. So.
Okay, I've tested all the phone lines, and it sounds like everything's okay with everyone's phone line. So, but if anything different is being heard by anyone in the chat room, let us know, and we'll troubleshoot live on air, because that's so entertaining.
Yeah.
But here's the grosses for the weekend. Shrek Forever After holding strong at $26 million for a cumulative total of $183.6. So that's a huge hit. Get Him to the Greek opened up at 17.3 in second place. The surprising thing is that Killers was very close behind in third place with $16 million, a movie that they refused to screen for critics. So that goes to the argument that, you know, some movies are critic-proof.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. For that courtesy screening they had Friday morning,
mm-hmm.
did they serve anything good?
Did you want, like, alcohol or something?
No, did they have, I mean, seriously, really, you know, something with, no chaser maybe would have been worthwhile, I guess. I mean, but.
It looks like a lower rent Mr. and Mrs. Smith, right?
It makes Mr. and Mrs. Smith look like Brief Encounter, as far as I'm concerned.
makes it look like a David Lean movie?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, it just does. If you're going to bring up...
Prince of Persia, fourth place at 13.8, which is a 54% drop from the week previous. That gives it 59.4. It's not going to make $100 million here in the state, I would think, which must be a disappointment for a Bruckheimer production. Sex in the City.
Sorcerer's Apprentice, they must be happy with that, will probably do well, unless they really botched that one, too. So,
what's successful? What is a blockbuster video game movie?
What do you mean, what is a blockbuster video game movie? Like, what
amount? What's the last blockbuster video game movie? Has there been one?
Well, there was one, but it was a long time ago.
Well, I remember
Mortal Kombat
was popular,
yeah.
but it wasn't.
But that was really the one.
I mean, it wasn't a $100 million smash kind of thing. It was.
I guess it would have to be the Tomb Raider movie, the first Tomb Raider movie.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, one of those, yeah.
I can't think of another, because I know there's been lots of other ones that certainly did not work, like Hitman and Max Payne.
None of those.
Yeah, those
were off.
Were stinker.
I'm just waiting for Tetris. Tetris the movie. Tetris the movie, baby. That's
what
it's all about.
If you think about it, if you really want to think about it, you could say, make the argument, obviously, that Tron was, but, I mean, it was a video game after the movie, though.
Yeah, it was a video game after.
Yeah.
Also, the Resident Evil movies have never been huge, but it's been a successful series. Like,
yeah.
They've continued to make money.
Yeah, they've got a fourth one coming out, so.
Yeah, in 3D. And I do think that in the future, it's only a matter of time before one of these video games that has been long gestating in the film, the film version has been long gestating, will be popular. Things like BioShock and Halo and things like that. I mean, if they made a movie out of one of those, there's a very good chance it would be.
I think BioShock or another one, Mass Effect, are the two vying for what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, they've been talking about a Pac-Man movie forever. I wonder how they do that.
Is Danny DeVito going to play Pac-Man?
I don't know. I don't know who they'd cast. But I want to talk a little bit about. I mean, we got some news about the next Batman, about Inception. We got. I want to talk about something else too. I've forgotten right now. but first, here's a little segment I like to call Jamie Reads His Fortune Cookie Live on Air. Okay. Is your interest peaked?
I haven't been this excited in a long time.
Okay, here we go. You will die an early death. No, that's not
no,
what it
says.
No,
it doesn't.
It says, today be civil, but don't go out of your way to be over-friendly.
Huh.
Okay.
In bed.
In bed, right.
There you go.
Is there a fortune in that? Does it bother you that you open up fortune cookies now and they don't have fortunes in them?
I was thinking about that
the last time I got Chinese.
Yeah.
They're sort of non-fortunes. They sort of say something that's like, it's like a little piece of advice or something, but
it's
not
like
really
Dr. Phil
open.
Wrote it.
Yeah.
Today, be civil. Yeah. But actually, I was joking with a good friend a couple of nights ago about if I were in charge of writing the fortunes.
Oh, God.
I would be so sarcastic. They'd be fortunes like they'd open up the cookie and it would say, it's malignant or something like that.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
I always thought that was a good idea. Unfortunate cookies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Something that said, like, look out behind you or something like that.
It is your baby. Okay, so the Joker will not be one of the villains in the next Batman, unequivocally, so that rumor has been laid to rest. Great idea, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean, you're just asking for trouble with that, otherwise.
I don't know about that. I don't know that it is a great idea. I do think that while Heath Ledger did a great job, I do think there are other actors who could turn in another memorable. Oh, let's not forget that we all thought that Jack Nicholson did the best Joker of all time, and people were shitting their fucking pants saying that no one else could do the Joker, and certainly not the gay cowboy from Brokeback Mountain.
No,
you
bring up a good point. Do you remember the outrage when that was first presented? I mean,
very much so.
Yeah.
People thought, like, oh, it should be either Jack Nicholson, and if it's not going to be him, it should be either Sean Penn or Crispin Glover or Paul Bettany, and then they cast Heath Ledger. And everybody, like, all the fanboys lost their fucking minds. Like,
yeah, but it shows you how wrong, what I love about that. And even, you know, I am curious, though, in this alternate reality, alternate universe, what if he had not passed away, the reception of the film, I would find very fascinating.
I think it would have grossed less, but I think that people would have been just as impressed with his performance.
Yeah, there's no way.
I agree.
I really agree with that. But the three actors you just mentioned were all viable candidates. But after watching the Bob Dylan movie with Heath Ledger, I'm Not There, I was so blown away by his performance in that, let alone Brokeback Mountain and Candy. I was just so...
God, can you imagine what he would have done with the remainder of his career? I mean...
That's the thing. That's so haunting.
And I think our conversation right now illustrates how... I think it's smart that they not reprise the Joker, for at least for this next movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I think so.
The thing is, I have enough faith in Chris Nolan. Like, by the way, Joker was not in the first Batman movie that Chris Nolan made, and it kicked ass. So,
yes,
like,
it did.
Thank you. I'm sure he can make another one without the Joker and, you know, have it be just as good, if not better. I mean, there's plenty of other villains. And the first movie really didn't even have any... I mean, it had Ra's al Ghul and it had the Scarecrow, but most, you know, 10 out of 10 movie fans have never heard of either of those people. Those are comic book nerds territory
comic book
only.
I've heard of those. But Cillian Murphy did such a great job, I thought. He has a screen. Both of them did, and Liam Neeson, too. They all, you know, it's really interesting. I do think, in some ways, I think Batman Begins is the more interesting film. It's going to always be overshadowed by that second one. But there are some really beautiful moments in that film.
Yeah.
I love the first movie. And maybe you're right then, having thought about it for another couple minutes. Like, you know, it might be more interesting to just see Chris Nolan move on and do something. I mean, after he made the first Batman movie, everybody was clamoring for him to make another Batman movie, and he made the choice people didn't like. He went and made something else. He went and made Prestige, and thank God he did. It's an awesome movie.
Yeah.
And then after Dark Knight, everybody wanted him to make a third Batman movie right away. And he didn't. He went and made Inception, which hopefully will, you know, be a cool movie too. So at this point, I'm just going to trust whatever it is he wants to do.
Yeah.
Chris Nolan has said, concerning Inception, he has said previously that this is the biggest movie he's ever done. And just recently, to a British newspaper, he said that this is his James Bond movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, piques a little interest. And he said, look, I'm very fortunate in that I get to work on larger and larger canvases. He's an ambitious guy, obviously. But I do hope that he returns here and there to movies like The Prestige and Insomnia, more intimate character-based. I mean, all of his films are strong because they do have memorable characters. But what are we eating?
What's going on?
Who's eating?
Are you stirring a drink or something, Chris?
Oh, I was stirring my drink there. Yeah. Wow.
Good, man. Share with us what you drinking, dude?
I'm drinking a Bloody Mary right now. Smoking a cigar.
Smoking a cigar and drinking a Bloody Mary.
That's right.
Wow. Yeah. You must be celebrating.
Come on over, buddy. You can have one. I'll make one for you.
Okay. Cool.
I've never had a Bloody Mary, man.
Well, come on over. I'll make you one. I don't know if you'll like it. It's kind of an acquired taste, but...
Right.
Do you think Inception, though... I know, I'm sorry. I just wanted to...
Here's Jerry getting back to what the show's actually about.
I'm all about alcoholism. If anyone knew how intoxicated I was before each show, they would be shocked.
Exactly.
But I think that was common knowledge for the last 3.5 years. But, let me ask you this. Don't you think Inception could be like The Prestige or Insomnia? Or is that not possible at this point?
No, I think it'll be a great movie, but this Insomnia works because it is the best example of that distinctly American genre of film.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
I think it's a genre movie.
Ironic,
Prestige.
It was a remake of a Scandinavian movie.
Right, right. But they Americanized it in the best way, I think.
They did. You're right. They did.
Yeah.
But Inception is something else, and he's admitted it. I mean, Inception is a mind warp on a massive scale.
Do you think it's like a...
Have you noticed all the slow motion in that trailer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every scene in that trailer is in slow motion. I wonder if the movie's going to be the same way. Which I have no problem with that. It's just that's the kind of filmmaking that Chris Nolan's not that kind of... He hasn't typically been an action filmmaker, you know?
Right.
True.
Well, and that was the complaint about The Dark Knight. The only complaint I really heard voiced through several critics was about the sloppily choreographed action sequences. I never necessarily found that the case. But
no, I didn't find that the case at all. I actually think that the chase, you know, when they capture the Joker, that whole sequence, the chase sequence, it is really well done.
Yeah. And I have no problem with slow motion as long as it's not a John Woo film.
Well, I don't have a problem with
right.
Well, the John Woo Hong Kong films, American films, don't
right.
matter. But I always think it is seem like the slow motion has become the norm in the first decade of the 21st century.
I think it's a big Matrix effect too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
The That's bullet time
point.
Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what else is going on? I would be remiss not to mention that one of our previous guests from last year passed Friday, or was it Thursday that he passed away, I think?
I think it was Thursday, I think.
Yeah. William Fraker, he was a very celebrated DP. Jerry, if you're near a computer, are you near a computer?
I am near a computer. I'm going to go look up some.
Yeah,
but,
can you IMDb
him? We had a great conversation with him when we interviewed him. And so while I'm doing that, I hope that you can fill the air.
Yeah, I just don't want to miss any of his credits.
Okay, here we go. Oh, wow, yeah. He died May 31st. But he had quite a resume. Let's just go through some of the President's Analyst, Rosemary's Baby, Bullet, Paint Your Wagon, The Day of the Dolphin, which I think I talked to him about, Day of the Dolphin. The original, The Killer Inside Me, which if you haven't seen, is a magnificent film. Looking for Mr. Goodbar, a couple of John Belushi films, Old Boyfriends in 1941. And towards the end, we got Waking Up in Reno, which is a very interesting take on Bob, Carol, Ted, and Alice, Town and Country, Rules of Engagement. Now, he was all over the place. Very
Cuckoo's Nest? Did you mention Cuckoo's Nest?
I did not, because I would figure that you would have said that, but
but we had him on for the Polanski show, and Chris, you're back on the air now. We had him on for the, yeah, your phone line dropped for some reason.
Oh, shit. I don't know.
Anyway, we had him on for the Polanski show, for the show we did on Ropo, and he was very complimentary of working with Polanski on Rosemary's Baby and almost working with him on Chinatown, and we talked about Bullet and Day of the Dolphin. I think you asked about that one, Jerry. And
yeah, mm-hmm.
He was just incredibly gracious, and I remember asking him at the end what's coming up for him, and he said, well, I've been very ill, so I don't know that I'll be able to do any more work. But such a sweet guy, and so he will be missed. Great films to his credit. But if you want to hear that interview, go back to our October 2009 shows, and you can hear it as part of our Ropo director series.
That's it. It's no longer Polanski. It's Ropo.
It's Ropo.
It's Ropo.
That's what I'm... Don't you love that, Chris?
It's just crazy.
Anyway, what else is going on? It's been slow news week, hasn't it, for movies?
Yeah, I guess so. I would have thought you had had your pulse on all this, but you're right. It is a slow news week.
I have my pulse on the fact that it's a slow news week.
Yeah, see, that's all you need to know right there.
This oil spill, man.
Oh, dude, this oil spill. Let's not even go there.
It's got a Hollywood connection, obviously. It started with Kevin Costner, who has been devising this machine that separates pollutants from water with his brother or something for the past, 12 years, and he tried to sell them on it. And now, James Cameron is in the mix.
Anytime
there's like a potential global disaster, they call it. He's like the new Armageddon crew. They'll call in James Cameron if ever there's a meteor crashing towards Earth. Don't you think?
I think so.
I think it's kind of interesting. I mean, the guy's always been on like the cutting edge of technology, and he's certainly shown that he has an interest in the oceans. Nobody has any answers, and obviously neither did James Cameron, because they haven't done anything about it. So,
he called them all morons.
Yeah, they are all morons.
Yeah, I mean, He really went out and said they don't know what they're doing. He almost sounds like Indiana Jones at the end of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. They have no idea what they have there. But that's exactly what he sounds like. In that one interview that was on in the middle of the week, he really – dude, this thing in the Gulf is frightening, and it's very scary because no one has a solution, and the solutions that they thought they had don't work. And, you know, I was telling someone the other day I didn't think I'd see anything as bad as the Valdez in my lifetime, but I am very wrong in that.
Well, it's 150 miles off the coast of Tampa Bay right now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I'll be here any time. It's fucked this state up for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. And it will make hurricane season
lives.
Worse.
Yeah.
Hurricane season is going to be bad this year anyway, so they've predicted.
Yeah.
But because instead of a tidal wave, you're going to get a black tidal wave coming at you.
It's very frightening. That alone, and that's going to, you know, and if we've had these problems in Maryland with the Chesapeake Bay, trying to save the bay. If this thing spreads, is what they're saying, to the Atlantic, forget it. I mean, you know, this is horrible. They say this thing isn't even going to stop leaking. The earliest is sometime in August.
Well, it won't stop leaking ever. I mean, they're
no,
going
it will be forever.
Stop it from leaking.
But
speaking of something scary, off of current events for a second.
Thank God.
John Carpenter just signed on for his next movie. Let's see, what is it? It's called Fangland. It's based on a popular book. It follows an ambitious TV producer who ventures to Romania for some exclusive FaceTime with a nefarious arms dealer who might be a vampire. Hilary Swank will play the journalist. His previous foray into vampire land was vampires, ironically enough.
It was awful.
And we all know how that went,
movie? The James Woods one?
Yes.
Oh, I thought, I was really disappointed. I'm not disappointed. I just didn't, I know a lot of that movie has a cult following. I'm sorry, I just couldn't get into it. Sorry.
Nah.
It was awful.
Yeah, thank you.
It was not good. Not good. Let's not forget that Hilary Swank makes two types of movies. She makes movies that win her Academy Awards, and then she makes every other movie she's ever made, which was, they're all awful.
So she's going to make the score, too?
Yeah, this does not sound like the former category.
But here's the thing. Carpenter used to be so much in his element, and then something... You know, there are people always give me a hard time because I don't like Escape from L.A. because I found it really disappointing, and it almost seemed dated even when it came out. It seemed dated, which is not a good thing for that movie. But I really thought the time to have released that movie was maybe 2 or 3 years after Escape from New York for it to have seen any sort of relevance. And
well, here's why I opened up the can of worms with Carpenter, because this is what I want to talk about.
Oh, God.
With Carpenter and then possibly with other people we can think of, because we normally do this kind of thing. I've always thought Carpenter was overrated. I always thought, like most of these horror movie guys that get the tag, you know, master of horror, the master of terror, and all that kind of stuff, that they haven't necessarily built a career on proving that. They've made one, maybe two movies that have done really well in the genre. And they've been writing that their entire career.
Yeah.
I feel that way about John Carpenter.
John Carpenter has made many, many more In the Mouth of Madness and Village of the Damned and Prince of Darkness and Vampires and Ghosts of Mars than he has The Thing or Halloween. The Christines very much outweigh the Things and the Halloweens in his repertoire. And then there's other stuff that people sort of like, but I think they sort of like it in an ironic way, like Big Trouble in Little China. I think they like remember it quite a bit more fondly than it actually, you know.
Well,
I remember
it
being a better movie than it is.
Yeah, I like the three he did with Russell, the initial three he did with Russell. I like Dark Star, I like Halloween, I like The Fog. But after Big Trouble in Little China, I like They Live. But after They Live, I got to be honest with you, you know, it's – God, I wrote an article about this actually a couple of years ago. And I said this to a person, and I said, you know, we like, you know, someone asked me, well, who do you like? You know, I go, we used to really like Ridley Scott and John Carpenter, but look what they've been doing, and that was in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And I stand by that statement today. While Ridley Scott got better in some ways, Carpenter, I think They Live was the last movie I really got to say that I liked by him.
It's particularly true, even though Carpenter has always fluctuated primarily between horror and sci-fi, but it is primarily true among horror film directors. The overpraise that is not earned. I mean, Romero hasn't deserved the level of, you know, goddom that he's received since, you know, maybe the early 80s, maybe Dawn of the Dead or something.
Day
you know?
Of the Dead may be the last one that you could really...
I don't
remember Day of the Dead being received even... But we didn't have the internet back then, but I don't remember Day of the Dead. It's only in hindsight maybe it's respected. But, you know, not even the 80s maybe, really maybe the 70s. But I don't know. I like Romero, but the last, let's be honest, he is cannibalizing, no pun intended, his own work. I mean,
yeah, and Tobe Hooper never registered beyond Chainsaw. I mean, he made Poltergeist, but, you know, wink wink, everybody kind of knows differently.
It's not a well received movie. I do like Life Force a lot, but that was 85.
That was summer of 85.
Yeah, and I like that movie a lot, but I know
that
we're not
covering on the show, but I guess we'll cover it on our roundtable.
No, I just like it. I have, you know, I just thought it was a fascinating film, but that was the last thing. I mean, that and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Okay, I'll even give you that, but after that, I haven't seen am I supposed to say The Mangler or whatever?
Yeah, I will not give you Texas Chainsaw 2. And I'm a huge fan of the original.
Dennis Hopper. That's the only reason that's why I like that is just because of Dennis Hopper. But,
which we haven't talked about Dennis Hopper yet either. We'll do that in a little bit. Thanks for reminding me.
Okay.
These guys, what other horror film directors? Or can we open it up to other directors?
I think
we did
Wes Craven. We haven't talked about Wes Craven yet, so I think we need to hit the brakes on this conversation. I mean, I don't think anyone falls into that category more than Wes Craven. You know, like, I mean, he's the one that's given that title. He sold off his own work. He's completely fucked out his own work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, making, you know, the whole thing with Scream when it came out. I mean, I'm going to give him that. Like, he had not made a good movie in a long time when Scream came out. I think the movie he made just prior to that was Vampire in Brooklyn or something like that. And then Scream came out, and it was an interesting sort of new revitalization of the whole teen horror movie thing. And then he continued to just drive it into the ground. I mean, it was embarrassing by the time he made Scream 2. It was even more so by the time he made Scream 3. And now he's going back and sort of, I don't know if it's a remake or if it's just another sequel or if it's like a Wes Craven's new Scream or whatever we're going to call it now. But this is just really embarrassing.
Well, he's going back to the site of his last hit.
Yeah, I mean...
The first Scream.
I like. I mean, I do like the first Scream. I'm not going to lie to you. I haven't seen it since I saw it in the theater, but I remember liking that, and I like the new Nightmare, and I like, obviously, the Serpent and the Rainbow, but I'm talking about that's generations ago with Serpent and the Rainbow.
25 years.
And also, it's tricky with Wes Craven, too, because I always say that his scariest movie, here's another master of horror kind of, title that he's given, but his scariest movie actually isn't very artfully done. It's not a very good movie. It's just really effective. I mean, but in terms of craft, and it's very sloppy. But there's just something about it that works even beyond his contribution. I think
I mean, to me, his most effective movie is the original Hills Have Eyes. If I was going to pick one,
okay, that's effective. I did rewatch that a couple of years back, and it was effective.
That scared the hell. I was talking to our good friend Roland about that, and that's the film. I think that for me, at least, that's the film that scared the hell out of me for a number of reasons. But that film, and I didn't need. And I do think the remake is very interesting. That's one of the few times I actually thought the remake had something to contribute. But, no, the original one, that's my favorite movie. I know a lot of people will always gravitate toward Nightmare on Elm Street, I realize, but for me, it's The Hills Have Eyes.
Right.
Well, this sort of brings up an interesting question, because these guys give them so, themselves these titles like Master of Horror, and I don't know who officially has that title, whether it's Wes Craven or John Carpenter or whatever. But who would you give it to then? You know, like, is there a director who you would say, like, what, is it one of those maybe who is the best horror movie director, or do we just sort of not have one? I mean, I think that might be closer to the truth. We just don't
have
anyone.
I think we kind of just not have one.
Yeah.
Because,
I mean,
because
we have guys who have made that their career, but we don't have anyone who's been quite good at it, you know, like, who's earned the title.
Actually, maybe the guy who made the French director, Jack Tournelles, and maybe the original Cat People, maybe. But, I mean, you mean someone alive now, though? Is that what we're talking about? Or
someone that
well,
made
I mean
a career of making exceptional yeah,
right, right.
Movies of that genre.
Todd Browning, maybe, or James Whale. I mean, those guys.
Well,
but that's a lie. No, realize that's like almost centuries ago in the way we live now. But I don't know. I don't know if anyone's a master of anything. I think it's so short-sighted in one sense. But this,
I don't know that that's true. I mean, I think people like Alfred Hitchcock earned the title of the master of
success. I think Alfred Hitchcock was, you know, I think it, by, if we mean horror and by today's standards, it almost belittles him if we mean it by, like, the whole what he...
Well, no. I'm not calling him a master of horror. I'm saying some people have a title like that. Like, mm-hmm. he was the master of suspense, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could say that, you know, like Woody Allen is the master of the intellectual comedy or something
mm-hmm.
like that, you know, like, I don't know what other titles you could come up with. I mean, like, you know, like Steven Spielberg, obviously, I don't know what you would call it, but he's clearly the master of something, you know.
He's
like,
he's basically the master of everything.
Yeah. He's master of everything, but let's talk about that because... It's the one lesson of Jaws no one seems to get. Less is more.
Right.
And Jaws is also just on its own. Forget the shark. I mean, it's a fascinating, it's a great story. It's just a fascinating story. But the thing that people, thank God the shark, Bruce, did not work.
Yeah.
Thank God.
And just great interaction between characters. I mean,
yeah.
You're interested in these people being thrown together.
I'm so interested in those characters. And that's the thing that people don't learn. I think it was Devin Faraci of Chud wrote an article, What If Jaws Was Made Today? And it would be 2.5 hours long. We'd have all these backstories. We'd see the shark immediately. It wouldn't work. It just
yeah.
wouldn't work. And I think Jaws is really the movie that a lot of people have to go back and watch because that's the way it's done.
Well, but I know that you recall how that came to be. I mean, there was a set of circumstances that made it so that they
yeah.
could not show the shark because it never worked.
Yeah,
but
this is
Spielberg's particular genius. If it had worked, he would have used it in that way. But
yeah.
it didn't work, but he is so genius at improvising, like playing it as it is. Like he would walk on the beach for the opening scene of Private Ryan. He had no idea how he'd shoot it. And he just
yeah.
improvised with the camera. I mean, he's so quick on his feet, such a fast thinker.
It's a good point. I was just about to say, people always make this, and you're right, Jerry. People make the argument that you just made, thank God the shark didn't work. And it is true, thank God the shark didn't work. But it's not he didn't coincidentally also make Close Encounters and E.T. and Color Purple and Munich and Schindler's List and Jurassic Park and Minority Report and
yeah.
all these other movies. It wasn't a coincidence, you know.
Yeah,
that lucky that shark didn't work, you know. Like, oh,
yeah.
he actually also, he got lucky that he got this and he got lucky that, you know, the CGI dinosaurs worked out. And, like,
right.
you know, he's just a really good director. Like,
yeah, he's got the best visual sense.
He really does.
You can't argue it, really. I did a show last week. I did Jason's show from Oscar. For anyone that's interested, I'll be meeting Jason for the first time ever tomorrow night in our 3-year friendship. It's the first time meeting.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go up in a hot air balloon together. But I did. There's a whole backstory there. But I did the show, and it was a Memorial Day show. Some people took offense to it because we were memorializing careers that should be dead.
what were the careers that should be dead?
Well, I don't recall everything that they chose. But I of course, recall my choices because they were brilliant. And the first one for me was somebody like Kevin Costner.
Okay.
Well, I think his career is pretty much dead, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's still doing work, but
I don't think that that necessarily applies to him as a director, maybe, maybe not. But there's something that happened with Kevin Costner around the Waterworld time when he stopped being the all-American guy you could root for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the perception of him changed. And I don't think it's recovered since, even though I think with something like Tin Cup and The Upside of Anger, mm-hmm. he got back to his roots of we started liking him in the first place.
Right.
You know, the rascally, you know, mm-hmm. guy next door, and kind of joyful performance he gave in that. The thing that turned me off to Costner for the longest time was just the constant brooding, and it was the same exact performance every movie, Bodyguard, Waterworld,
mm-hmm.
just the brooder that just irked me.
Mm-hmm.
He mistook brooding for depth, and instead it was just boring.
Well,
okay,
I agree with you in that he is more interesting when he's doing, you know, the guy next door kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the truth is, anyone who's ever seen an interview with Kevin Costner knows that quiet, brooding type is what he actually is. Like, he was actually acting in Silverado, and he was acting in Tin Cup, and when he does Open Range and Waterworld, well, that's just him phoning it in. Like, that's what Costner does. I mean, that's Costner being Costner.
He was interviewed at a press screening that was out of Open Range. And
which is a good movie. I'm not trying to shit on that movie.
It's an interesting movie, but he was very defensive the whole time because the thing was, I guess after Waterworld and especially after The Postman, for him to direct again, he was not paid up front because there was a lot of, it was in called into question, could he deliver something? And he was very defensive on that. Whenever the questions came up to that, he would say, look, you know, I did this on, you know, could I bring this in? I took no money for this. He was on the defensive, and it was a very fascinating thing to watch. This was, I guess, in the summer of 2003.
See, I like Open Range fine, but it's another example, performance-wise, of Costner's performance and the way his role is written.
Mm-hmm.
It is that same brooding pretentiousness that I dislike about him. I like his direction of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's reciting things that aren't earned. He's so laser-focused on creating the movie moment that he doesn't build up to it and invest you in a way that makes that movie moment genuine. Like, he all of a sudden will pop out and tell Annette Bening this, you know, love mm-hmm. monologue about how much he loves her and everything. It feels like it comes out of the blue. Have we been invested in this relationship up to this point? Same thing with something misguided like The Postman. You know, he's so into that. It seems like he just made that movie for that last shot of the bronze statue of the postman with the mail.
He did.
Ridiculous.
It's a great book. The sad thing is, it's a great book by David Brin, and it doesn't take you quite as long to read the book as it does to watch the movie. But, I agree with you, Jamie, on that. Yeah, I do.
Another one was Travolta, and we talked about that last time you were on the show, Chris, where you named the last 10 years of his of his output.
Yeah.
Director-wise, I can't remember who I chose. I chose, I think, Kevin Smith.
The problem with Kevin Smith is you know, when we talked about this, Jamie, a couple months ago when he had that outburst on Twitter, but Cop Out made as much as his previous films, and for him to all of a sudden just of all the films that you want to defend, Cop Out is the film you really want to defend. I mean, I would have gone, you should have gone back to Zach and Marie or something, Cop Out. But Cop Out made the money that a Kevin Smith movie would make. Maybe a little bit more than a Kevin Smith movie.
Yeah, but the problem is it cost more in it.
It didn't. No, you're absolutely right. I'm not defending. I think the movie is, it's a labor to watch.
Well, but this is the thing with Kevin Smith. When was Clerks? 94? Was it?
94. 94.
So we're talking 16 years, and Cop Out comes around. He says, man, I finally made a movie that actually looks good. It looks like a movie. That amateurish thing does not work when you've been in the business 16 years already.
It would have been fine if it was Jay and Silent Bob as the cops. No one would have had a problem with it.
I mean, it's not charming anymore.
Yeah. No, those films were good. I like his when he But those films have a limited appeal. They are inside jokes. And I'll be the first to say, as much as I love Kevin Smith and his films, those films are served. It's hard to make, if you're making films for, God, I hate to say this, for your base, you've got to be prepared when your base also doesn't go out to the movies as much as it used to. You have to be prepared for that outcome.
That's exactly right.
You know, I do like the Kevin Smith films, all the films that deal with that, the view askew verse or whatever it's called. I like those films, but I also realize that you're catering to your base. The problem when your base doesn't come out, who's going to come out?
Right.
Yeah.
Very true. And it's
when my base comes out, stand back.
And I think he found that out the hard way with this film.
Yeah. Yeah. He's lazy. That's a good point, Dean. That's what I'm trying to say. Another one was, and we've talked about this ad nauseum, so we don't have to mention it anymore, but I'll do it anyway. It was Oliver Stone. It's not that I don't think Oliver Stone can't make a good movie again. It's just that the Oliver Stone that we fell in love with, I think, is dead. Is he? I think he's dead. I don't think it's the public's. How about what?
The documentary about the South American leaders.
As a documentarian, he you would think, as a documentarian, yeah, he could make that impact again. But his documentaries are so outside of the subject itself, they're handled so mundanely.
Yeah.
They don't stir the shit like a Michael Moore documentary does. Oliver Stone should be making Michael Moore documentaries.
No, you're right. I agree with that.
Instead, he's making talking head stuff. I mean, maybe the Showtime miniseries he has going on of documentaries will be a different ball game. And he's still an incredibly proficient, effective technical director. He still gets great performances. I have no doubt of his ability there. I'm talking about content and fire and passion that is missing from his earlier work. Maybe that has to do with getting older. I don't know.
I'm sorry, bud.
Another choice of mine was, maybe this is a bit premature, was The Rock. And I think I think he can easily rebound. But the contrast or the parallel, really, to the better candidate for a career who's died is Eddie Murphy. Because The Rock is doing a lot of the same stuff that Eddie Murphy did.
The
Rock came out with a very – yeah. He's Disney-fying himself with every role, and all the movies are getting progressively worse, and he's losing his kind of identity. He started out very strong, The Rock. I think he could have made a great impact in action movies, and I think that he could branch out. I think he was the best thing about Be Cool, because it was unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little that's best about Be Cool, but...
No, you're right.
But I think he's losing his way, as did Eddie Murphy. And Eddie Murphy, I completely blame him for it, because he won't take risks on – he's very slow to take risks on the material that is worthy of him, of those efforts. And he's quick to pick up the paycheck movie. He always has been.
Let me ask you this, though, about The Rock, because he did. He came on with a lot of charisma, The Rundown, even the Walking Tall remake, or even – I mean, I think he's incredible in Southland Tales. Well, I know a lot of people.
He could have been our generation's or this generation's Chuck Norris.
He could have, you know, by doing movies like The Tooth Fairy or The Game Plan or not even that. Or, you know, let me ask you this. What do you think of this movie that we've been seeing trailers for, The Other Guys?
The Other Guys. I haven't seen
that one
yet.
With Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Do you think that could be something? I'm just throwing that out there.
Possibly. No. I mean, he's doing stuff like Get Smart and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's some good stuff there, fun stuff. But a lot of fun stuff. But it is he is going down an Eddie Murphy route. You're right.
He does have. I don't know how much talent he has. I think that he does have talent, but more than anything, I think he has a charisma that he's underutilizing with the projects he's choosing. I don't see that there's any growth in the course that he's taking.
Mm-hmm.
He will not grow as an actor doing Tooth Fairy every year, you know?
Right. That's anyway. True.
That's my point.
No,
brilliant observation, Chris.
Brilliant observations.
I think Chris is stunned in silence because of.
You might have hung up.
Well, I mean, I agree with your appraisal of the Rock's career right now, but I definitely have a problem with the parallel between him and Eddie Murphy. Like, I mean, I think that. What's that?
What's your problem with it?
Well, I think that in his time, Eddie Murphy was terrifically talented. Like, and
yes.
I do think that The Rock has charisma. I do not think that he is in any way, or nor was he ever talented. Like, I think he's gotten a lot of mileage off of fat hillbillies who watched him for years. You know. Wrestle around on the mat with other dudes, you know.
You're right. The parallel I was making is not in the talent. It's in the choices.
That's what I'm saying. I agree with that part of it, but, Eddie Murphy at one point was terrifically talented, you know, and The Rock is just not.
Yeah, The Rock is just not that.
Yeah, The Rock could not come up with a Dreamgirls. I mean, I'm not expecting that. but even Eddie Murphy didn't really follow through on Dreamgirls. He didn't even want to do Dreamgirls. And, you know, I don't know. His career has been set to self-destruct for a long time. And, you know, I don't know if Axel Foley is going to bring it back.
Didn't bring
no,
him back
will not.
The third Beverly Hills Cop. I mean, that was
a director, Martin Brest, is somebody that needs to be making movies again. And he might, because he has been rumored to be the director of Midnight Run 2, which, of course, is a sequel to the movie that he directed, Midnight Run.
Oh, well, that would be great. Now, Robert De Niro will return as Jack Walt,
yes,
right?
And it's rumored that Charles Grodin will return as well.
Thank God.
Yeah, but the rumor is that he will return in a very small, like, cameo-type part, right?
Right.
As I understand it. I mean, that... The whole thing that worked so well about Midnight Run was the charisma and the chemistry.
Chemistry between the two, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so while I love the idea of Martin Brest, and by the way, I don't think that Martin Brest is the guy that needs to make this movie. I think anybody could make it. Although I do like Martin Brest's movies. I just don't think there's any directing style in Midnight Run in particular that Martin Brest brought to the table. But without that kind of chemistry between the two main characters, I have a hard time buying that this movie is anything anyone gives a fuck about.
Yeah.
It has
well,
to be really...
And I don't know that people care about the De Niro character as much as they were feeding off the chemistry between the two of them.
It is the chemistry. Yeah. I mean, it was a great film. And obviously,
yeah.
Its influence can be felt today in a lot of films that we've seen over the last couple of years. But, I mean, Chris is absolutely right. If you don't have that dynamic in the film... I mean, isn't it almost like it's almost going to be like a footnote to the original movie instead of a sequel?
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Like Be Cool was with Get Shorty.
Yeah, I mean, and here's the thing I have to say about Be Cool, though. I love Elmore Leonard, and I read everything by him. I was not crazy about the book to begin with, Be Cool.
Yeah, Elmore Leonard is another one of these guys, very much like Robert De Niro, who puts out a lot of work. And for every for every Rum Punch, there is a Maximum Bob or something like that. That was just not very good. Like,
no,
he puts out lots of stuff.
Be Cool was the one that I thought, for me at least, because I really went, I discovered Rum Punch, I guess, in 93. That's when I finally decided to read Elmore Leonard, and... he's one of my favorite writers, but Be Cool was the one that just didn't, it was the one book for me at least. That was the only book I wasn't crazy about. The others, the things that he found, but that one, as a book, it wasn't crazy about it. So as a movie, it didn't surprise me, it didn't work.
Well, I mean, who knows?
And it had a great cast.
We got to talk about Dennis Hopper. We've gone too far.
Yeah, we really do.
Yeah, Dennis Hopper, who was battling prostate cancer for a long time, he finally succumbed last week. And there were it was strange because everyone knowing that he was on his deathbed for a while, there were retrospectives and tributes and honors and things happening months before he died.
That's true.
You know, and it, almost like in anticipation of. But what was his identity? I mean, he was obviously he was a maverick.
Don't use that word.
Well, I don't. Well, I don't want
to use that word. That 2008 destroyed that word. Find another word.
No, I don't give them that much power to destroy a word.
No, it destroyed. I refuse to associate Dennis Hopper, regardless if he changed sides.
Well, those two fucking idiots deny ever, you know, even really calling themselves Maverick at this
point. I realize that.
Like, we're in the age where they called themselves Mavericks for 9 months straight, and then now they go on tape saying, oh, I never really considered myself a Maverick.
And like, I know, yeah. I realize that. It's just the word. When I hear the word, I think of her saying it, and it's,
okay,
it's like, it's scary.
All right. He was a pioneer.
Let me put it to you in
this Dennis Hopper conversation.
He was
Dennis Hopper.
Talk
of Sarah Palin.
Can we just say that? Can we say that he was Dennis Hopper? Do you need to say anything else? You don't need to use.
Of course you do, or else the conversation ends right now.
No, he was Dennis Hopper, and that carries so much weight with me.
Yeah,
it really does.
Really is true. People really didn't. I don't think that the media spent enough time talking about Dennis Hopper. You know, the thing was, he wasn't the best actor in the world. He wasn't Robert Duvall, and he wasn't De Niro, but the thing was, Dennis Hopper was so original, and he was so, when he was on screen, and I was not his biggest fan, but when he was on screen, he always did it in a way that only Dennis Hopper, the only way I can think of him is, like, it's like if you play chess, there's all these different pieces on a chessboard, and, you know, like, you take one piece, and it's just unique, it's just the bishop only does what the bishop does, you know, and
yeah,
it's not always the most useful piece on the table, but when you need it to make that one particular move, that's what it does. And that's how Dennis Hopper was. He was like the bishop. He was limited in what he could do, but nobody could do that quite like Dennis Hopper did. You know,
yeah,
nobody could have played what I consider to be one of the greatest scenes in the history of film, like in the interrogation scene between Chris Walken and Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
You know, in True Romance. One of the greatest scenes of all time.
Yeah.
And Dennis Hopper played it in a way that no one else. I mean, you can literally read that script and read that dialogue and think of ways that other actors would have played it. And other actors might have played it well. I'm not saying Dennis Hopper did it best, but no one would have done it exactly like Dennis Hopper did.
Those mannerisms, those facial expressions. I mean,
yeah, the little smile, the little crooked smile and stuff, and like, you know, the way he smoked the cigarette when he finally asked for it and stuff. Like, and not just that scene. Like, he was that way throughout his entire career. Like, even in the shitty movies that he made, like Waterworld, you know, and that part was offered to a ton of people before Dennis Hopper finally accepted it, you know. And Speed and lots of other things that he did.
He made the shitty movies worthwhile.
Yes.
To an extent. I have to say this, though. 25 years ago, I dragged my mom to see a movie, My Science Project, on the sole reason that Dennis Hopper was in it. And that was, I must have been going into my sophomore year in high school, but that was the sole reason to go see it. Dennis Hopper's in it. And he was a nut job in the movie. But he had this way of popping into these, he got this brilliant second chance, if you will, because no one was going to give him a part after the fiasco of the last movie. That was he lost it, and he ended up in a psychiatric ward. But he was in some really, if you think about it, he in The American Friend, the photojournalist in Apocalypse Now, who was really the court jester of Kurtz's compound. I mean,
it is really funny, his character in Apocalypse Now, because that movie is so wildly depressing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so, I mean, it's a great movie. It's literally one of my 10 favorite movies of all time.
Oh, yeah.
But it's so wildly depressing and such a long, terrifying trip down this river into hell. And then when you get, you're almost sort of relieved, and Court Jester is the exact perfect explanation. You're almost sort of relieved when this character pops into the movie and brings a little levity.
Oh, yeah,
there's
none before that. There's none.
Right.
Whatsoever.
There's absolutely none. I mean, there's sort of situational levity, but there's no character that brings that sort of life. and it works perfectly. And that's, you know, that's partially because of Francis Ford Coppola, and it's also partially because of Dennis Hopper. I don't know that there's any other actor on the market at that time who you could have cast to play that part who would have done it.
Oh,
maybe Jack Nicholson is the only other guy who I
can think. The only other actor, I think, and it's his German counterpart, I've always said, is Klaus Kinski. But taking that, that's just a personal observation from my childhood, but what makes that whole part of the movie is because I think Hopper and Brando hated each other with a passion. Hopper never forgave Brando for making fun of James Dean, for insulting him, and I think there's a scene in the movie where he throws something at Hopper. That was deliberate.
Yeah, calls him a mutt.
That was not a he's just like, that was, and that adds to what makes it such a fascinating film. But Hopper was, we're not going to get someone like that ever again. He was in these small movies, like he just had these one or two scenes, like in Jesus Son or Basquiat or Search and Destroy. But he also made a movie that no one's seen called Carried Away, where he was very good. He was very refined, like he was in Giant, as Rock Hudson's son. Very normal, if you will. No craziness whatsoever, and he was very good.
Well, and I love it how he has gone out with one of his, and we've discussed it on the show before, one of his most surprising and emotional performances in Elegy, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's he's fantastic in that. And that was foreshadowing, I guess, in some ways, his performance in that.
And one of the most surprising and kind of tender scenes in a movie in recent memory when he kisses Ben Kingsley.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of leaves your mouth agape, as it did Ben Kingsley's.
Probably wish he was doing that instead of Prince of Persia.
But you know, and he had a renaissance. I mean, he started a trend. He started a movement with Easy Rider.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of tried to maintain that identity, that rebellious identity, at least in his directing work throughout his career. But then that renaissance that happened as soon as he got cleaned up
with
Blue Velvet and Hoosiers. You know, and you felt that really spoke to, you know, the insanity that he was capable of portraying on screen with Blue Velvet, and the demons that he suffered in his real life with Hoosiers. You felt like he was purging himself in both of those roles.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and he was so great and iconic in Blue Velvet that David Lynch, who is the, you know, who's such a unique filmmaker, I've almost felt like he sort of tried to recapture that sort of lightning in a bottle type character a couple other times. Like, I feel
he
like
even did it with a guy that turned out to be a real life killer in Lost Highway.
Well, exactly.
And he couldn't match it.
Right, right. And it didn't quite, it was creepy, but it didn't quite work as well as it did with Dennis Hopper. And then he tried to do it in the same movie with Robert Loggia. And he tried it a couple other times, but he was never quite able to capture that character. I mean, he wrote it exactly the same, but you needed somebody like Dennis Hopper to bring that character to life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One of the creepiest scenes in the history of filmmaking.
Yeah.
like popping the amyl nitrate and, you know, saying baby wants to fuck and all this stuff. Like, I mean, it's so bizarre. This kind of movie, and it's one of the, and it's a moment in movie history that is referred, so he's probably in two of the most important scenes in the history of movies, because that's a moment that is referred to in other movies. Like, if you think about The Squid and the Whale, you know, they go, Jeff Daniels, you know, wants to go with his son and his son's daughter, or his son's girlfriend to go see a movie. He talks them into going to see Blue Velvet, and they all have to sit through that scene together, you know. It's so uncomfortable. It was so over the top. He was one of those chess pieces that we have in Hollywood. Like, you know, he really is like, even though he doesn't have the acting chops, he is a Robert Duvall, or he was a Robert Duvall, and he was a Paul Newman, you know, he was a Jack Nicholson, you know, in his own way.
Well, he tells a story all the time. He told the story all the time about the that Lynch wanted him to use helium for Blue Velvet, and he said it should be some mind-altering thing. It shouldn't be helium because it just raises your voice up octaves.
Right.
But then he thought years later, he was like, man, that would have been a weird choice, though, if he would have been talking like Donald Duck as he was doing all this stuff.
But it wasn't, I don't think it would have been as menacing. Maybe it would have been as menacing. I don't know.
Actually, Dean has brought up in the chat room, there are two roles. River's Edge, which is, just crazy.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There's a film that
was the year after Hoosiers. That was that period of renaissance for him.
He's in Nick, as far as I'm concerned, one of Nicolas Cage's best films, Red Rock West. He's great.
He's
creepy. You talk about creepy. He's just insane in that movie, and that's just a very well. I still think it's probably John Dahl's. I know I love The Last Seduction, but I actually think I like Red Rock West a little bit more.
I was just about to say, we were just talking about directors, or we often talk about directors who sort of disappeared and what the fuck ever happened to them. But what the fuck ever happened to John Dahl?
He made
He made a lot of really good movies.
He was like a modern film noir director.
Yeah, he was very good. He made a couple good movies. And then he made the Ben Kingsley movie, You Kill Me, which was good. But that was three years ago.
I wasn't nuts about that movie, but even when he made like mainstream fare, stuff like Joyride, which was a really, really effective movie. I mean, it benefited a lot from having a guy like Steve Zahn, and then a couple of sort of throwaway actors like Paul Walker and Lou Zobieski. So that sort of says like what a strong filmmaker he was. He was able to make that movie work even with these sort of throwaway actors. Of course, he did have Buffalo Bill for the voice.
Yeah, that's true.
Whatever happened to him? I don't understand. Like why we lose a director like that? He's a fairly young guy.
He did kill me, and that's the last we've ever. I don't know what he has on the horizon. I mean, but that was
that movie maybe killed him.
No, I thought that was an interesting movie. I like Ben Kingsley, so I mean he was good in that as opposed to Prince of Persia or whatever.
But something like River's Edge, came to mind when you mentioned that. And Dennis Hopper's the kind of guy that could act across from a sex inflatable sex toy like he does in River's Edge.
And what's great?
And you don't question it.
No, you don't. But what's great about that is he is in the company of an actor a younger actor, Crispin Glover. Who has all those elements, or at least in that time period did. And Crispin Glover is a wild motherfucker. He got kicked off of Letterman for trying to kickbox Letterman at that time. And Crispin Glover does every couple of years, makes these wild movies.
Have you heard an interview with Crispin Glover?
Yes, I have.
Where he comes across as like the most cordial kind of Midwestern guy.
Yeah.
Which makes him even creepier.
Hey, speaking of Crispin Glover, you asked me earlier if I saw any movies, and I sort of forgot that I did see a movie recently that is somewhat new. Anyway, it's new to DVD. I saw the Alice in Wonderland movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I know you saw it, Jerry. Did you see it, Jamie?
I saw it. It was not a weekend I like to remember, but
I did see it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. Wow, that movie was bad.
And
that movie was very, very, it was very, very poor, was it not? I mean, that was really, really, really not a good movie. I mean, I just don't even know how else to describe it. It was just a complete mess.
And
was
it's
I the
a
only
billion
one
dollar grosser.
One,
I know, it's just a huge grosser. Was I the only one that was wildly confused during that movie?
No.
I think I was a little drunk. I was a little drunk like I always am when I watch movies. I mean, that movie was incredibly confusing. Like, I didn't understand why anyone was doing what they were doing and where they were going and why their motivations for saying what they were saying and doing what they were doing. I was completely confused.
Based upon a fairy tale that has lived on for a long, long time, it has no sense of storytelling.
That is
Tim Burton's weakness in his weaker films. Yes, he's
and this is the weakest
films.
Of his films, I think, actually. But
really portrayed that more than any movie he's ever made. I mean, I thought at the very least it was going to be something like Sleepy Hollow, something that's just like, it's Tim Burton doing a story. It's Tim Burton doing a story you've heard of before, but it's him doing his Tim Burton version of it. No, the movie was very confusing and very frustrating, Like, I was so... and it wasn't even entertaining. I wasn't
even really interested
in what was happening.
Let me ask a question, though. I need to ask a question. Was it a sequel to Alice in Wonderland? Because you got the impression that she had been there before. Like the Alice in Wonderland had taken place already, and she comes back, and I was just like, you've got to be, what, I mean, I was just like, really, do you have joints that you can pass out at the theater? Is Disney going to pass out drugs for this movie?
That's absolutely right. It should have been called something like Return to Wonderland or something like that. And I don't think it would have made quite as much money had it been called that. So obviously that's why they called it Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah,
but it really was more akin to something like Return to Oz. Like that's
really
I know.
Where as fur as a balk, you know?
I can just imagine that his next movie, Sleeping Beauty, should probably be retitled Sleeping Audience, because that's exactly...
Or entering Sleeping Beauty, re-entering Sleeping Beauty. But,
well, if you're into that sort of thing. But I realized I was on allergy medication when I saw it, so I was in and out. But
no, but I mean, they really, I was really surprised. Like, it's like the Robin Hood movie they just made. Oh, it's a prequel to, it's what made before he became Robin Hood. It's like that. I mean, give me a break, guys.
Yeah.
So you're
I
right.
I saw that, and I also saw The Lovely Bones, which having read that book, I thought the movie was sort of damned from the beginning, like, because that book is so goddamn long, and so the whole point of the book, just like the point of the movie, is not what happens to the girl, but what happens to the family and to the world after she leaves the world. That's always been sort of the point of the book. And that was the point of the movie, but they weren't able to really express that in the movie the way they were in the book. It just wasn't long enough. They just never really stood a chance, I don't think, to be able to sort of capture the details that they had in the book.
You're right. You're absolutely right in that regard.
And there were moments and pieces of the movie that worked really, really well. And then I got to say, like, I hate to fall in line with everyone else who criticized the special effects and the heaven portion of the movie. But that was just every time they flashed back to that was the part of the movie that did not work. Like,
that's always work. That's what I thought. Look, Lovely Bones was on my top 10 of the year. But understand that I do not come from someone that's, I haven't read the book. So I don't know what's missing. I just know what's there. And also understand, I do think that the parts of her being in the in-between plays was the weaker part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the effects made it look like a screensaver. But the stuff on Earth, the stuff at home, was very palpable and emotional to me. And that the climax of her getting that first kiss was very emotional to me. I mean, I almost get emotional thinking about it.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie, let me tell you, if that's how you felt about that movie, I strongly recommend that you read that novel, because
I don't want to ruin the movie for me.
I agree with
Jamie.
Like
all those things you're talking about, like her getting her first kiss, those are some of the moments that did work very well in the movie, but they are so much more fleshed out in the book because there's so much more backstory that they just simply could not. It's not a fault of the filmmakers. They just simply could not go into all that detail in a movie. The thing would be 12 hours long, you know? If that's the stuff that affected you from the movie, I strongly recommend that you read that book, because I think it would be one of your favorite novels of all time.
Yeah.
Chris
brings up a very good point. It's just a very good point in general about books to movies, you know, books that are very well regarded or well received. It's just, you can't. It's very hard to reproduce the effect in the novel on screen. And this is a case where it's just, you couldn't. There's no way. Chris was right. 12, I would think 15 or 20 hours maybe.
Yeah, I think it's just an unfilmable book. I think there are some books that are just unfilmable. I think this is one of them. I think Confederacy of Dunces is probably one of them. I really sort of hope that they never make that book into a movie, because it's another one that's just, it's the exact same thing as Lovely Bones. Like, it's a different tone from Lovely Bones, but there are some books that are just, you can't film because there's just too much internal dialogue. The Road is another example. Like, too much internal dialogue. You cannot put that onto a 2.5-hour movie, or even a 3-hour movie. It will not work.
But could you understand the argument about Lovely Bones that people found the premise and the ending of it offensive?
Absolutely not, because that stuff is there in the book. That stuff is there in the book, you know. And again, maybe it's because it's a 2-hour movie and they weren't able to spend the time on it that they were in the book, but I did not find it offensive. You know, the whole Roger Ebert argument, I guess, is what you're referring to, I guess, right?
Yeah.
No, I completely disagree. I think he was sort of reading that. And, you know, the thing about that that surprises me is that Roger Ebert is a literate guy, and he reads a hell of a lot more books than I do. I have to believe that he has read Alice Siebold's book, you know, and it's just so hard for me to believe that he truly felt that way about it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It made sense to me.
I don't know why he found offense to Lovely Bones and not Ghost.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing. It's making things right back on Earth before you reach your final resting.
Right. Mm-hmm. You speak of
uncomfortable. He seemed to be, like, making the point that was, like, their whole purpose was to meet up or something like that, and I didn't get that at all. Like,
they can all rest now because their killer has been caught. Yeah. I don't see that as offensive.
Let me ask you guys.
And I thought Stanley Tucci was fantastic in that part.
He was.
Actually, like,
he was really,
of all the things in that movie that worked quite well, he was definitely. I was not nuts about Rachel Weisz. I was not nuts about Mark Wahlberg. I just there was just not enough time spent on those characters like there was in the book for you to really care about them. But the Stanley Tucci character, actually, they might have spent more time in the movie than they did in the book on that character. Like, there was really not.
Go ahead, Jerry.
No, I'm sorry. No, you're right, though. I mean, it is hard for a novel like that, for a two-hour movie, you're not going to be able to duplicate that. But you talk about unfilmable books, and at the time of its release and for many years after, I always felt Dune was unfilmable. Dune is very in the mind. You talk about characters that, you know, it's really more about what's going on through people's minds and everything. That's a hard thing to film.
Again, though, Dune is another one. You say unfilmable in terms of a two-hour movie. Or even a three-hour movie. But when they went and made that miniseries
of Dune, it
was quite a bit more, you know, palatable, if you've ever read the Frank Herbert book. It's a lot more palatable to watch the miniseries because they sort of, if you sit and watch the six-hour miniseries, you sort of spend time building up the sort of things that he builds up in the book, you know.
Yeah.
Some books are just like that. I mean, that's the nature of having, you know, like, that many words on the page. You can't boil it down, you know, if it's a great book in that many words, how can you boil it down into one-tenth that many words,
right?
You know, like, you just can't do it, you know.
Yeah. Good talk, guys.
Very good talk, yeah.
We'll be back tomorrow night. Hey, Chris.
Hey.
We don't have a show next Sunday, but we're on this 80s series Monday through Thursday this week. Monday through Wednesday next week, and we're going to have a critical roundtable next Wednesday about the summer of 85 and the movies. So you are invited to participate.
Hey, I'm always down for doing a show where we're sitting around talking. I will say, though, my wife is pregnant now.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. She can be very moody these days.
No, I understand that.
I was going to announce it, but I didn't want to announce it for you on the show unless you're ready to. So.
Oh, no.
I'm excited for you.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I did not know.
Thank you. No, yes, we are expecting our first baby. Yes. And actually, as it sort of pertains to movies, it comes to mind now, like, you know, no one ever influenced my taste in movies more than my mother and my father. So having a kid, like, sort of exciting, you know, like, as a movie lover, because now, like, literally, like, I can't think of two people that influenced my taste in movies more than my mother and my father, because I spent, you know, like, so many years just watching the movies that they were into and, like, hearing them talk about them before and during and after those movies, you know, whatever they were, whether it was Alien or Jaws or, you know, 5 Easy Pieces or whatever movies my parents liked. So one day I'll be having those conversations with my kid about all the movies that I love. So that's very
right.
Yeah.
That's right. And you'll steer your child clear of Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, my God.
If we've learned anything this show. Well, we congratulate you, dude.
Yes.
Good work. Good work, sperm.
Thank you. Yeah, I blasted that one right in there. Yeah.
All right. We close with the score for the new movie, Killers. Is it Killers? Is that what it is?
Killers? I think it's Killers. No, no, there's no article in front of it. It's just Killers.
There's no the.
I think it's called Kutcher's Last Movie in Theaters.
That could be very true. You could be very right there.
All right, guys. We'll be back tomorrow night with Steve Guttenberg as part of our 80s series and every night after. Thank you for joining us, everybody.
All right, thank you, everyone.
Thanks.